KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, San Francisco's transit agency, Muni, was launched 100 years ago this month. It was the first publicly owned transit system in a major city in the United States, and the inaugural line ran on Geary Street between downtown and 33rd Avenue. Now, Muni has about 700,000 daily boardings, runs 63 bus routes, 7 light rail lines, a historic streetcar line, and 3 cable car lines. And Muni has been transporting and frustrating customers throughout the century. We'll discuss the history and current state of Muni. That's next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. When the then San Francisco mayor, Sonny Jim Rolfe, inaugurated Muni, the municipal railway, in 1912, he spoke about it as the people's road, built by the people with the people's money. Indeed, now in its centennial month and year, Muni was the nation's first publicly owned land-based transit system in a major U.S. city. With over 200 million customers a year and 700,000 daily boarders, 80% of whom are city residents, Muni, with its 63 bus routes, 7 light rail lines, and the historic F line, as well as 3 cable cars, is among the highest per capita public transport systems in the nation. And in this morning's opening Forum Hour, we delve into the history of Muni, transformed from the gold rush, local stagecoach transportation, railroads and steam locomotives and streetcar lines, to the present-day San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency, which operates and manages the city's integrated surface transportation network, including all modes of public transportation, paratransit, parking, traffic, and tax regulation. And we talk this hour about Muni then and now. Joining us in studio is Rick Lobsher. He's sort of our historian resident this hour. He's also board chair and president of Market Street Railway, a nonprofit historic preservation partner of Muni, and former radio guy for those of you with long memories, many years at KSFO. Rick, good to have you here.
Thanks very much, Michael.
And we also have Ed Riskin with us, who since 7-Eleven, since July 2011, has been Director of Transportation at San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency. Ed, good to see you again.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Also with us in studio is Gerald Cawthon, who was recently part of SaveMuni.com. They're a citizens group that was fighting the Central Subway and coming up with ideas to improve Muni. He was formerly Chief Project Manager of the PUC's engineering projects, including Muni, and worked with Muni from 1970 to 1992. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good to have you all here, and I suppose congratulations are in order, centennial year. All of you have been involved in Muni for a long time. Let's go back, to the origins, if we can, with you, Rick. We're talking really about voters at the turn of the century, angry, really, at the private streetcar companies. So they approved a bond and created a municipal streetcar line.
Yes, but not on the first attempt. I mean, it goes back to the city charter of 1900, when eventual ownership of all public utilities was made official city policy. At that time, the water department was privately held, and the transportation that was provided was also owned by utilities that made a profit and were in business to make a profit. They had a big network of cable car lines running up and down Market Street and branching out Haight, Hayes, Castro, lines, some of which still exist today as Muni bus lines. And what happened was that there were a couple attempts to actually get the voters to pay for publicly owned transit in, I think, 1902 and then another year after that, and they turned those bonds down. Then in 1906, when the earthquake hit, it devastated the cable machinery and shut down the cable car system on Market Street. The private company, United Railroads, went in and said, we want to string up overhead wires, which the beautification advocates of the day had fought very hard against. So they did the expeditious thing. They bribed the entire Board of Supervisors and got their permanent overhead wires. And so Market Street became a streetcar street.
You also had huge labor strikes.
They had a huge labor strike in 1907. It was very bitter. This was a labor town then as now. And there was a lot of ill feeling against the private company. So when another bond issue came up in 1909 to buy the outdated Geary Street Cable Railway, which was privately owned separately, the voters said, yeah, let's buy it. they amazingly tore up all that old cable car track and put in brand new streetcar track, overhead, power plants, car barn, everything within a year, and opened the municipal railway on Geary Street with the A line from Market and Kearney down to 33rd Avenue.
They both were running at the same time, private and public. You
know? Private and public. Yeah. And soon after that, Muni, under the guiding hand of M.M. O'Shaughnessy, the city engineer who came on board, and Mayor Rolfe, went into an aggressive expansion policy, first to meet the demand that they knew was coming from the 1915 World's Fair, which was built in what's now the Marina District. So a whole bunch of streetcar lines were built up Van Ness Avenue, over Union Street, out Chestnut, through a tunnel, the Stockton Tunnel, which they dug specifically to get the streetcars through. And then in 1918, they opened the Twin Peaks Tunnel, which was the longest streetcar tunnel in the world at the time. And all of a sudden, Muni was out in what were then the open sand dunes of the southwest quadrant of the city, building, a community.
And you mentioned the overhead. I mean, this was really quite innovative at the time because they were using really mining technology. This was 100 years ago and applied it to the track, to the transit, excuse me. There's a name that surfaced, at least in my research. This really led right to today's modern system. The Scottish immigrant, Andrew Halliday.
Yeah. Well, Halliday invented wire rope cable systems for mining applications. And then in 1873, he opened the first cable car line in San Francisco. The cable car lines before Muni revolutionized transport because before then, it had been steam trains, which were very noisy and messy on Market Street, and then horse cars, which were slow. And, we don't have smell-o-vision, so when we look back, we have no idea about the incredible amount of effort it took to, regulate and clean up for horses. So cable cars were really a blessing. But that technology became superannuated within 10 years by the electric streetcar, which came to dominate San Francisco's transit technology, really right through the World War II era.
Yeah, but you go really back, and you've got horse-drawn omnibus in the 1850s, and then local stagecoach during the Gold Rush, of course. But Civil War, I was looking at, there was a red line that was reincorporated as an omnibus railroad. I was looking at just some of these numbers. They had 15 miles of track, 90 men, 140 horses, operating 24 cars. By 1875, there were eight companies along 80 miles, 700 men, and 1,700 horses. Right. Well, I think about all the horse manure, like you said. I mean,
well, a lot of
the
people,
mind boggles.
A lot of people don't know this, but they actually had work cars in the old private competitor to Muni that would gather up horse manure and take it out Lincoln Way on the tracks and dump it in Golden Gate Park. And much of, what we see and enjoy today in Golden Gate Park was carried by streetcar from downtown.
And there's still a lot of horse manure, but in a
different
sense. We're talking about Muni and its history, and we are hearing that history from Rick Laubscher, who is a great oral historian, also board chair and president of Market Street Railway, which is a nonprofit historic preservation partner of Muni. And in the course of this hour, I'm going to really tap into you, our listeners, and hear perhaps some memories about Muni from you going through the years. I mean, Muni used to be, and let's bring you into this, Ed Riskin. For all the years I've been in broadcasting, it used to be sort of the number one issue for a number of years, when Jordan was mayor, when Willie Brown was mayor. Maybe it's a credit to you and your leadership that we don't hear about Muni as much. I mean, people call in and complain and tell you my bus line isn't on time and, it's too crowded and all that sort of thing, but boy, it's just not as much on people's minds, perhaps, as it was.
Well, I think Muni, like any other system of its stature, has its ebbs and flows. I think the reason why it has figured so prominently in kind of the public discourse in the past, off and on, and probably will again at some point in the future, is that it's so important to San Francisco. It's so integral to the way we move around the city. We're now boarding more than have more than 700,000 boardings on an average weekday. So it's really a core part of the economy of the city. And when things aren't working well, we can impact a whole lot of people.
So also, when I look back at Muni's history, and it becomes in some way, I mean, despite all the complaints that I've heard through the years and so forth about Muni drivers and about, like I said, not being on time and breakdowns and all that sort of thing, it's really been in the vanguard of so much innovation. I mean, let's give props where they're really deserved here. I'm not only talking about environmentally, but that comes to mind immediately, but in terms of the disabled, in terms of getting African-Americans. I mean, Maya Angelou was a Muni operator. A lot of people don't know that. Cage Bird Sings fame and so forth. A lot to be proud of.
Absolutely. It's an amazing and rich history, and I think it reflects a lot of who we are as San Francisco. During World War II, Muni was really one of the first major public employers of African-Americans, and that's a tradition that has stayed to this day. As you reference, it was in the 70s, in advance of the Americans with Disabilities Act, that the city adopted full accessibility policy for Muni. So that there have been a lot of groundbreaking efforts, support for minority and women-owned businesses and disadvantaged businesses. Those have all been a part of the ethic of the organization while it's been moving these 700,000 people a day.
Well, it kind of reflects, in this sense, Rick, you know, what San Francisco has been. You said labor town, but also, you know, moving forward in terms of progressive ideas. And talk a little bit about, if you would, the role it had for, say, for African-Americans or for women.
Well, in the run-up to World War II, San Francisco was very much a town governed by Irish and Italian people. You know, in those days, the real estate listings in the paper were by parish, not by neighborhood. It was somewhat of a club. And in World War II, we had
there was a club, by the way, called the Three Eyes, Irish, Italian,
yes,
and Israelis.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And there is a big there was a big influx, as everyone knows, I think, of African Americans to work in the shipyards and other war industries during World War II. At the same time, a lot of the regular Muni employees had gone off to war, and the city kind of broke what was an informal ban and made it difficult for African Americans to get city employment. And there was a very large influx of African-American platform people, conductors and motor men, as they called them, at Muni. But they still needed more people, so they recruited women. And they couldn't quite call them motor men, so they struggled for a term and started calling them motorettes. But you had women running the streetcars. You had African-Americans. And this was a sight that was not, you know, common or comfortable for some San Franciscans, but they quickly got used to it. And then African Americans became the dominant group of Muni employees. And one of them, Curtis Green, rose from being a bus driver to being the first African American general manager in the American transit industry. And another gentleman, Welton Flynn, became the head of the Public Utilities Commission for many, many years. So this is something that Muni ought to be and is really proud of.
And talk about, if you would, Ed Riskin, and then I want to also hear, of course, from Gerald Cawthon, who's here with us, who's been somewhat critical of Muni, hear what he has, and also hear from you, our listeners, in terms of how you feel Muni serves you or doesn't, or what memories you have of Muni, and we'll open the phone lines shortly. But there's been a lot of press given to a couple things that I want to touch bases with you on, Ed. One is Homeland Security and new surveillance system. Where is that now, and what kind of progress are we at? What stage are we at?
So all we're doing is upgrading the existing camera equipment that is on the vehicles. The camera equipment we use primarily for security and investigation of accidents. It's very valuable when we have an incident on a bus or on the street to be able to pull the video and see what happened.
But this is a Homeland Security system, too, we're talking about.
The current grant funding for the replacement of the on-vehicle camera equipment comes from a Homeland Security grant.
Yeah, and that's at what stage in terms of?
We just awarded that contract, I think, a couple of months ago. So it's
still
it won't be on the buses till next year.
And there's also, I noticed, a two-year battle by youth activists to free Muni for Youth program. That went through successfully.
It did, and I would probably put that in the category of the progressive values of San Francisco influencing transit. But one thing that this movement brought forward, and this was the impetus for this, was the demise of the yellow school bus system, the increase in the cost of Muni. The fast pass for youth went up by more than doubled in the last few years. What kind of came to light is that we base our fare structure, we discount based on age, not based on need. So we have perhaps very wealthy seniors or children of very wealthy families who have a very deep discount in their Muni fare, whereas low-income people of all ages don't have that. Low-income adults get a 50% discount. All youth get a 70% discount.
Of course, through the years, a lot of people would say, why shouldn't Muni be free? Why isn't it free? I mean,
And it is something Mayor Newsom had commissioned a study a number of years ago to explore that, and the study determined that to not be feasible. But what the MTA board did do was approve a pilot program to test the concept of making Muni free for low-income youth, and that's something we'll be starting in March of next year.
And again, Ed Riskin is presently the Director of Transportation for the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency, and I mentioned that the Transit First policy is now embedded in the city charter, remains there, and Gerald Cawthon, you've been around Muni for a number of years, have seen it evolve, metamorphose, change, and so forth. What have you liked most and what have you been most critical of?
Well, first I want to say it's a very complicated system to operate, and I think it's easy to underestimate just how difficult it is if you've got 1,200 large units moving through the city, all operated by human beings who can make mistakes, and in an environment where you really never know from minute to minute what you're going to be up against, especially when you've got traffic that varies minute to minute or hour to hour, and it changes day to day, so it's almost impossible to schedule for that kind of fluctuating environment. So that's one.
You're making me think of my dad's old wise nostrum to us when we were learning how to drive. Think about every other person on the road as being nuts. And to some extent, I mean, a Muni driver has to constantly deal with a lot of crazy drivers and crazy traffic situations.
Well, that's exactly what I tell my 17-year-old right now, by the way, is everybody else is going to make a mistake, so you don't. But Muni is very complicated. I think Ed Riskin inherited it at one of those low ebbs he mentioned. And as you say, things have gotten quieter, and that may indicate that some things are being done. We feel at, say, Muni that the resources have been, in some cases, misallocated so that the attention hasn't been where it should be, which is proper maintenance and a care and attention to operations and deployment of operators at the right time, schedule adherence, all of that, which can be improved with Muni itself, but it also requires changes beyond the scope of Muni to control all by itself or the MTA to control. So that is, I wanted to say one other thing. Rick Laubscher mentioned that when he was back in the early part of the 1900s, it took 1 year to put a very extensive Geary light rail system into operation. When I was at Muni, I started there about 1970, and in 1970, the Muni Metro subway was, most of it was on the in the back of the envelope stage. There was virtually nothing, and yet that went online by 1981. So that was about 10 years, less than 10 years to go from almost nothing to getting it into operation. Today, it would take about 30 years to put a new system that complicated online, but from the planning all the way through, and it's mainly because the processes have gotten so much more complicated, so much more difficult to control, no matter how good the Muni structure is.
I think what I'm hearing from you, and maybe get Ed Riskin to address this, is it's a huge behemoth bureaucracy, and getting maintenance through doesn't necessarily expedite, given that huge bureaucracy.
Well, I think we fully agree with Jerry that investment in the maintenance of the system is really essential, and that's something that hadn't been happening. And that last year, the MTA board did adopt a budget that reverses that trend and makes a pretty significant investment. And the second year of our two-year budget will be an additional $25 million a year. These are the mechanics who are doing the preventative maintenance on the buses, on the trains, the rails, the switches, the signals, the overhead lines. And I think that's something that we hadn't been doing as well as we needed to. And that's something that has direct manifestations in the quality of service, the reliability of the service. So I think that's absolutely true. It is complex. It's a complex operation, as Jerry was saying. We have the most diverse transit fleet, I think, of any in the country, if not the world, from cable cars to the historic streetcars, modern light rail vehicles, electric buses, diesel, hybrid buses. It's a very complex system operating in a complex environment. It's a very dense city. We have a lot of traffic of all types, bicycles, people on feet.
You've been promoting all these sustainable modes of transportation. I mean, that's been going on for years now.
Right. And the more we can get people in those modes, the fewer automobiles that we have on the streets to contend with. Congestion is a significant impediment to Muni's being able to deliver service on time.
You've been kind of in the vanguard of alternative fuels, too, we should mention. I mean, again, I don't mean to sound like I'm promoting Muni here, but a lot has been accomplished. What are you doing for this 100th anniversary? What do you got planned?
So we had a centennial kickoff event that was chaired by our former mayor, Senator Feinstein, who's been a great supporter of Muni from the time she was on the Board of Supervisors.
From the time she went down the slide. I remember that in her bathing suit. Not the way bathing suit is used metaphorically, wearing a one-piece bathing suit. Yeah.
We did a partnering with Market Street Railway. We did a trolley festival on November 4th and 11th, two Sundays in November. We brought historic streetcars out to the neighborhoods, and including some of the unique vehicles we have, such as car number one, this the same car that Mayor Rolfe piloted that day on December 28th, 1912. Market Street Railway is helping us decorate some of the historic streetcars that will be running down Market Street. On December 28th, we are going to celebrate our birthday by inviting everybody to ride Muni Free for the day. Just a little thank you to the people of San Francisco. There's a lot of great history. A lot of good work has been done to archive and document the photos of Muni. They're on display right now at the San Francisco Public Library.
They're also on the website, and we're gonna get some of them up on our website. And also, let me invite listeners, as I said earlier, to join in this conversation, talking about Muni's history, talking about Muni yesterday and today and tomorrow. And you may want to add your voice to this conversation. We certainly welcome hearing from you, memories of Muni, or thoughts about perhaps what it does well, or from your perspective, what it needs to do better. We welcome your calls. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. It's toll-free from anywhere. 866-733-6786. You can also email us, and we also welcome your emails. forum@kqed.org is the email address, or post your questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or you can go to our Facebook page or tweet us, and our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. And coming up on a break here, but Rick Lubscher, 1964, the cable car system was declared a National Historic Landmark. But back in 1947, Roger Lapham, grandfather of our friend Louis Lapham, tried to close the cable car system down.
Tried to close the Powell Street lines because Muni had purchased them along with the rest of the Market Street Railway company, its competitor, and a woman named Friedel Klusman stood up at a time when women had no power in San Francisco, certainly not in civic circles or in government circles, and said, as a citizen, this won't stand. And she enlisted a women-led group, by and large, that just said, no, this is part of our heritage, and it is valuable to our city, and you're not going to do it.
Well, by this led to Proposition E, in fact, ultimately, we should mention, for those who have that historical memory. And we want to hear your historical memories. When we come back, we'll do that. We'll listen to what you have to say. Again, you can join us in a number of ways, by phone, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org, or on our website, kqed.org/forum. And Judy, do we have pictures up on the website? We will, okay. Have some of those historic photographs on. We're with Ed Riskin, Rick Lubscher, Gerald Cawthon, and you when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about Muni as it turns 100 years old. Hard to believe, but this is the centennial year of Muni. San Francisco's transit agency launched 100 years ago this month. It was the first publicly owned transit system in a major city in the United States, and the inaugural line ran on Geary Street between downtown and 33rd Avenue. And now Muni has 700,000 daily boardings, runs 63 bus routes, 7 light rail lines, a historic streetcar line, and 3 cable car lines, and has been transporting and frustrating customers throughout the century. We're discussing the history and the state of Muni, and I'm going to have Ray Rezos join us, retired grip man for Muni and actually San Francisco native, grew up here. His dad was a train man. Ray, good to have you with us. Good to have you aboard. Welcome.
Good to talk to you.
You feel you had the best job in San Francisco, huh?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's there's no other job like it in the world. You know, you meet people from all over the world, and it's kind of an art. Learning to grip a cable car is kind of complicated, but when you get to do it, it's really a fun job.
Well, what's the thrill of it, other than meeting people? I mean, give us your sense of, you did it for many years, what excited you most?
Well, you feel kind of like a part of history. The cars operate today very similar to the way they operated in 1873, and it's a unique kind of skill required. People think that you have to be a big, strong guy, and that's not necessarily the case. You have to have the right touch because you're trying to grab a moving cable. It's similar to a rope tow for a ski lift where you've got this moving rope and you want to grab onto it. And you know, you have to do it carefully or else you'll shoot forward and you'll get what we call a jump, where the car can actually come off the rails. It'll jump up a couple of inches and come back down again, but it's a sudden start. You go from 0 to 9.5 miles an hour instantaneously. So you have to learn to get the feel for that and get the car moving gradually. And stopping is a problem, too, sometimes.
A lot of deftness and agility you know, tactile hand movements, as you suggest. You got to be quick.
Yeah.
You still got that touch, you think, now that you're retired?
Well, I haven't gripped a car for about 4 or 5 years. I retired about almost 4 years ago now.
I'll bet it's like riding a bicycle. Yeah. You could probably go back and do it again.
I think I could, yeah. I go back every now and then and ride with people and, you know, see my old friends and stuff. And sometimes I say, oh, you want to take it up the hill? And I say, no, I better not. I could put myself in a lot of trouble, I think. So.
Put yourself in traction, yeah. But you got a lot of good memories, huh?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a very interesting job. You know, I started when the cable car system was rebuilt in 1984, which kind of was tying in with the Democratic Convention that year, which was held in San Francisco. And in 1982, the Muni determined that the system was too far gone to be, you know, patched up. So it was basically torn out between September of 82 and June of 84. So I don't know if you remember, if you were here at that time.
I was.
All the streets were torn up. Powell and, you know, all of the lines were torn up and totally all the conduit was replaced. And surprisingly enough, the job came in on time and within the budget, and they got it going again by the time the Democratic Convention started. So it was kind of a feather in Muni's cap. And they made some changes to make it safer. There were things called butt joints where the slot would have a joint between the two pieces of metal, and if they weren't aligned perfectly, the grip could hit that and stop the car. Uh-huh. And we had situations, this is before I got there, but I've heard stories about gripmen going out the front window because the car stopped so fast, and even at 9.5 miles an hour, that's a pretty abrupt stop. So they eliminated that kind of thing, and they made the system safer. But there's still things that can happen. I don't know if you've heard about a strand, if you know what a strand is.
I don't.
Well, the cable is it consists of several wires which are wound around each other. And if one of those outside wires breaks, it can start to ball up behind the grip. And once it starts to strand, they have a number of little alarms in the system. They're basically like a little fork that the cable runs through. And if one of those strands is sticking out, it'll trip that fork and it'll stop the cable. But every so often, one will happen where it catches the grip and the cable car is unable to stop. The cable is moving, and as long as the cable's moving and you can't get rid of it, you can't drop it, you're going to just keep going at 9.5 miles an hour.
Yeah, this is will make people think differently when they ride the cable cars, for sure.
Well, yeah. Actually, it's a lot more. The hazards are more involved with the passengers because. You know, if you came up with this system today and went to a transit agency and said, hey, I've got a great idea. We'll build these little cars and we'll use 2x4s for brakes, because that's essentially what the brakes are, is blocks of wood. And we'll put a little 9-inch board along the outside of the car and people can stand out there and wave. And there's no protection against, you know, if the car runs into the side of a cable car, the people are just standing there. So they'd probably laugh you out of the place. But, you know, this is what the technology was in 1873, and this is what we've continued.
This is what we have. Ray, I'm pleased you could talk with us. I hope you enjoy your retirement, and I thank you for being on Forum.
Okay, thanks.
We're actually going to move along here. We're going to go to your calls, and lots of people want in here, but I'd be remiss if I didn't give Gerald Cawthon back the microphone here, because I don't want any tomatoes thrown at you by all these Muni critics. They expect you to be their voice here.
Well, let me definitely hasten to talk about some of the things we think the Muni could still be doing better than it's doing. As I said before, there was, maybe still is, a misallocation of very scarce resources. There's not a lot of extra money to be putting into it. There's 70 existing lines out there. Every one of those lines have got some kinds of problems. Now, some of the problems are unavoidable. Some can be addressed. If you give that to a consultant, he'll go out and he'll write a report. It'll take him 2 years to do it. And when he comes back, people will tend to have forgotten why they had the report. And the ideas in that report, you're still at the bottom of the mountain. So it doesn't really work to just turn it over to a consultant and forget it, which has been a tendency. What I've seen work at Muni when I was there at least 3 times is a very carefully selected task force or group of dedicated people who have a job, the full 40-hour week, devoted to looking at the small things that need to be corrected in the Muni system, line by line, hurdle by hurdle. That has not been in evidence. There's been a lot of inattention paid to the things that, and I'm not talking about just somebody's shelter that they want to move a half a block. I'm talking about things that impede the vehicles every day on every line, most of them. That's number one. A second one is that the Muni Metro system, which I was instrumental in putting online along with a lot of other people under Dick Sklar's great leadership, and he was a wonderful leader of not only Muni but Water Department Hetchy as well, that system was designed for 4- and 5-car trains. If you go around the world, the subways are usually about 10-car trains. The reason this one is 4 and 5 is because there are 5 lines feeding into the subway, and they wanted to have a direct service from 5 different parts of San Francisco. But 4- and 5-car trains is a reasonable subway for a relatively small and compact city like San Francisco. In the 1990s, long before Ed Riskin's time, they decided to go to 1- and 2-car trains. Now, there were some reasons for that. There was some difficulty with the coupling. They wanted to get past that, although coupling is done successfully elsewhere in the world. But here, they weren't able to make it work. But what they forgot was the effect of that on a peak period carrying capacity of that Market Street subway, which is probably today a $5 or $10 billion subway. So we went from I did a little study when I was working for the Transportation Authority a few years ago about the difference between BART's capacity up downstairs and Muni's capacity upstairs. Downstairs, BART can carry about 18,000 seats, or not carry. They have about 18,000 seats that they pass by a given point in an hour. Upstairs, Muni has 5,400 seats that it can pass by the same spot. So Muni's capacity during the peak period is about a third of BART's, and as it's turned out, that capacity is inadequate to cover the demand of people who want to use the Muni system for commuting. So what it does is drives the people who don't like being crammed in like sardines back to their automobiles. I think that one of the things that should have been much higher priority is a struggle to see if they could do something about the deficient capacity in the Market Street subway system and make that subway really do the job that was put into. I'll mention just one other here. Another area of tremendous neglect is the fact that coming in from the south, you've got 18 freeway and highway lanes coming in, northbound lanes. There's probably 30 altogether, but I'm discounting the residential streets.
Just you taking notes, Ed Riskin?
Good. Just the major highways and freeways, 18 lanes. Now, from the north, San Francisco is well protected. There's only 4 incoming lanes. From the east, there's 5 incoming lanes. But from the south, there's 18 lanes. And that, and in fact, the a number of automobiles that enter San Francisco from the south are about double what the other two are.
Now, you saved one of the most complex problems for last. But let me go to our callers here. Lots of people want to talk with us. Sarah, you're first up. Join us. Hi.
Oh, hi. I'm Sarah. I'm from San Francisco. And I grew up riding Muni in San Francisco. And I have stopped riding Muni because of witnessing countless drug deals. And was sitting next to a kid one time who had his wallet stolen from him. I just didn't know what to do. One time some kids tried to set my sister's hair on fire. Mm. And I just don't ride the Muni anymore.
Ed Riskin,
I'm wondering if there are any plans about what to do about that.
Well, Sarah, I'm sorry you've had those experiences, and Ed Riskin comes up all the time, different lines, problems. I alluded before to San Francisco Muni buses getting a makeover with the Department of Homeland Security. In fact, we had a report on it. Is this going to do much for the kinds of problems you have with vandalism and the sort of things she's talking about?
The technology certainly can help, but obviously a presence such as police presence is helpful as well. Crime generally on Muni is down, except for the category of except for larceny, which is pickpocketing and theft of handheld devices, which people are increasingly using and are increasingly inattentive while they're using. But while crime generally is down, we still have issues. We work very closely with the police department. We've increased the number of fare inspectors we have on board that aren't there to necessarily directly deal with crime, but the additional uniform presence on the system is extremely helpful. We also have something called the Muni Transit Assistance Program, MTAP, where we send folks out, people from the neighborhoods out in the afternoons when the school kids are riding, to deal with young people's behavior on the buses.
These
ambassadors
problem.
Of ours have relationships with the schools. They engage directly with principals of schools where kids are being problematic. So, generally, by any objective measure, Muni is a pretty low crime system. But experiences such as the caller has, it only takes one of those to really turn people off, and we want people to be able to be and feel safe when they ride Muni. So it remains a top priority for us.
Well, let me hear from some more of our listeners. Peter joins us. Hi, Peter.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to say, first of all, that I was born and raised in Los Angeles, and I love taking public transportation in San Francisco, although I have to say L.A. has been really growing by leaps and bounds, but that's not why I was calling. My question is, with talk of floating this idea of rail returning the Geary Street rail lines and also extending the Central Subway possibly to North Beach, and then I've even heard talks of going to a word of it going to Fisherman's Wharf and then turning into going to Fort Mason. Are there any plans on the drawing boards that for the next 10, 20 years beyond the Central Subway, that any major capital projects that we can possibly look forward to or even just want to know what's on the drawing board?
Ed Riskin.
So the San Francisco County Transportation Authority, which is a separate agency from Muni, is currently developing the next countywide transportation plan, and that's planning out transportation through, I think, 2030. And so in that process, we're looking at where they're looking at where the growth in San Francisco is going to be, where the current capacity is inadequate to meet current or in future demand. And from that process will come ideas for future expansion. The caller already referenced the Geary BRT and perhaps future light rail, which has been an idea that's been out there for, I think, 20 years, further extension of the T3rd. Up into Fisherman's Wharf, Geneva bus rapid transit or rail line. There are a lot of things on the books. If you go to sfcta.org, you can get engaged in that planning process and see what might be in the future for transportation in San Francisco.
All right. I'm going to go to more calls in just a second here, but did you have something on here, Jerry Cotton?
Yes. there's two things about this. So one is I hope that when this study is done, it's very coldly objective and it looks at the real needs as opposed to falling into the trap of taking somebody's pet project that's got political momentum. And if the professional class, of which Ed and I and all of us have been in it at times, they certainly are still in it, if the professional class stays silent on those issues, then it falls to the lowest common denominator, which is some politician who's trying to help some friend, and that's how these funds get misallocated. I come back to that 70 existing lines. Some of those changes and improvements probably aren't very exciting to people. They're just small things. But taken all together, they will have a much greater impact on people's propensity to use Muni, along with the safety and security and comfort that you talked about before, than any one vast project that sucks up all kinds of capital.
Yeah, so Rick Lobsher, you had something.
I was going to second what Jerry said in the sense that historically, Muni did what it wanted to do in the early years. If M.M. O'Shaughnessy wanted to dig a tunnel under Stockton Street, he dug it. And if the hotel foundation next to it collapsed, then they paid them some money and they went away. There was no public input process as we know it today. In the early 1980s, when we passed our first sales tax to build more Muni things, I was on the Citizens Advisory Committee, and there were two projects that were supposed to go to, you know, through the planning process together, and then one would be selected. One was Geary Street Light Rail, as the caller mentioned. The other was 3rd Street Light Rail. I think it's fair to say by any ridership potential or current measure, Geary needs that transit, needs rail transit, because it's one of the most heavily ridden bus lines in America.
Came up the last time we had a program on Muni, in fact.
Absolutely. But what happened was, in the public outreach process, there were some people along Geary Street that didn't want to give up diagonal parking, that didn't want the vehicles, the streetcars out there, whereas the community in Bayview Hunters Point really wanted that line. And that's how the decision was really made. It wasn't really made on transit need. And, you know, that's what a political process is about. But everybody ought to have their eyes open about that.
I'm going to ask you actually, I want to get another historical note from you. But let me, before I do that, get to some more calls and emails here. Viola writes, when I was pregnant with my second child, I was 10 days overdue. Tired of waiting for something to happen, I decided to ride the J Church streetcar from Noe Valley to downtown, hoping to jiggle something free. By the time I made it back home, I was ready to go to the hospital. 3 hours later, I gave birth to a healthy daughter. Thank you, Muni. And this always comes up when we talk about Muni. Ed, you may want to address it. I'm sure you have in the past. Kathleen writes, my kids and I rely on Muni, really appreciate it, but I wonder why so many of the drivers are so surly. I recognize that driving a city bus can be a tough job, but it's a good job, pays a good salary, as it should be. So why are so many of them mean and borderline rude? What about customer service? When I do run into a nice driver, I take pains to thank him for helping me with directions or just being pleasant. This is something that keeps coming back over and over again about Muni, about the drivers and how surly they are. Yeah,
it is. I think it's a relatively small percentage who are, but when you encounter one, it really sticks with you. It's a very difficult job. Just operating a large vehicle like that through the streets of San Francisco alone would be difficult. You add in all the traffic, you add the passengers, you add the fact that, you know, they can't get up and stretch and go to the bathroom.
No excuse
it's,
for rudeness.
It's a very difficult job. One thing I think we haven't done is
excusing rudeness here, are you?
Absolutely not. I don't think that we as an agency have provided adequate training for operators in the customer service aspect of their job. Our training is traditionally focused on the operation of a vehicle.
Is there any training about that?
There is, but it's pretty minimal. And we're soon going to be – we've been talking with the union, who's supportive of this, is really screening for customer service skills right at the front end when we hire people. It's a customer service job. You can teach most people how to operate a vehicle, but not everybody is cut out for customer service. So we're going to change the way we screen and hire operators. But I think by and large, most of them work very hard, do a good job, are reasonably professional and courteous. But we've all experienced those that aren't.
I want to read a couple comments from our Facebook page. Monica writes, one time on the 71, two homeless guys got in a fight and one guy started bashing the other guy's head into the window and blood went spraying everywhere. There's a reason I moved to the East Bay. It's called Muni. You're taking your life into your own hands most days. Marianne says, the most frustrating thing about Muni is the lack of fee enforcement. Muni is facing fiscal crises of its own and so can't run on time, has cut lines and services, yet many passengers are let on for free constantly, and there are rarely ticket officers on board to catch these evaders. It's unfair to those of us who pay for the ride. This came up when Newsom was mayor. I mean, it was a big issue. I haven't heard a lot about it since then, but you do have a lot of people just getting on for free.
We do, though. As I mentioned, we've increased the number of fare inspectors we have. We've changed how they're deployed and kind of how they operate. Our citations, fare evasion citations, are up more than 70% over last year. So they're much more visible. They're much more active. And we think as a result, we will see fare evasion go down. It's not, I don't think, as rampant as people think. We estimate a loss of something on the order of $19 million a year. So it's absolutely significant. But we're really starting to see that change. And I think by and large, most people are paying their fares.
And we were asking for memories. Here's one from Elizabeth on our webpage who writes, one of my favorite Muni episodes, getting on the J Church at 30th Street to head downtown for weekend classes at around 8 a.m. on Saturday with the Missionaries of Charity, Mother Teresa's order. One day in particular, about 20 nuns got on the train, settled around me, smiling and praying with their rosaries as we headed inbound. They got off at various points en route to head to their assigned work for the day. I felt as though all of us on the train must have received extra blessings that day. Can you, if you would, Rick, talk about the historic F-Line a bit and give us a little scope on that?
Well, the F-Line really is Dianne Feinstein's creation. When the cable car system was torn up, as your Gripman caller mentioned, there was no transit available that would attract visitors or others who wanted that experience. And so the surface tracks on Market Street were then available, the old tracks, because Jerry's Muni Metro had just opened full time. And so we gathered up like an old Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland movie. I was the volunteer project manager of that effort. Streetcars from around the world and ran them up to the Castro because that's where the tracks went. And this was so popular with the Castro neighborhood and with everyone who wrote it that the mayor came to us and said, I want you to do it again next year because I got the Democratic convention here. And we did it the next year, and that turned into the permanent F line, which was a line that Jerry and early planners had envisioned for years but had never had a proof of concept. So now we have what is America's busiest traditional streetcar line, busier than the New Orleans line, which operates more cars. Importantly, it links together a lot of destinations around town that people want to go to, not just tourists, but the folks in the Castro for whom it is the neighborhood trolley. I took it up to the Castro Theater last night, you know, and you see a complete cross-section of San Francisco on the F line as you do on many Muni lines. So it's been a huge success.
And let me get another caller on here who's been waiting patiently. Morris, that's you. Good morning.
Good morning. I had a statement and a question as well. I ride the 54 line to get to my job, and invariably every day I'm late because I usually have to wait as much as 45 minutes in order to get the train, and I miss my connection. So I work at San Francisco State, so I'm always late. And I've done an experiment with several friends of mine in Oakland. We leave at the same time, and they've gotten to their homes in Oakland before I can get to my home here in San Francisco, and it's very frustrating. I end up paying money on BART so I can get to work quicker because I can't rely on that line.
That line, Ed Riskin, you know, I've taught for many years at San Francisco State. You hear students all the time saying, I'm late because of the Muni. How seriously do you take these kind of suggestions when somebody says, you know, this just isn't running on time, I'm not getting to work?
We take it very seriously, and we have data to back up what Morris is saying. And it's really a result of a few things. One is the lack of investment in the maintenance in the system that we are currently reversing. And the other is making sure we have operators available. We need an operator and a vehicle for each scheduled run to make the scheduled service work. And then we need to make sure that the conditions in the street, as Jerry was suggesting, are working to help make transit move, which is one of the reasons why the MTA was put together, putting the old DPT and Muni together. And we've got a long way to go. We don't have nearly the performance we'd like. We want Morris to be able to rely on the 54 to get to San Francisco State, and we've got work to do to get there. But I think we're starting to turn the corner and move things in a good direction.
Well, let me bring another caller on, and that's you, Harry. Join us. Hi.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to say that millions and millions of dollars are spent every year on these so-called fare inspectors, and they're ordered to give a ticket no matter what. I've seen people that have a valid, Clipper card, which is another disaster, by the way, forget to swipe the card because they've been working 14 hours and still get a ticket, and there's also no easy appeal. We used to have weekly fast pass, we used to have tokens, we used to have paper fast passes, and now we're stuck with this Clipper card, and I think that if they're really serious about getting this system operating, they should eliminate the fare inspectors and go to another system and quit worrying about every single person doesn't pay because many people who don't pay can't afford it. Meanwhile, we just have this ridiculous bureaucratic system of fare inspectors that needs to go.
Well, I've got another email here, if I may, Harry, and thank you for that call. Joseph says, I refuse to believe that the amount of money spent on the salaries of fare inspectors that have become an ever-present annoyance on Muni lines is justified by the money collected in fees from fare evaders. This is money that could undoubtedly be better spent in a way that actually improves the service. But lots of people who have suggestions, where can they reach you, Ed, if they have specific suggestions?
Best way is by email, ed.riskin, R-E-I-S-K-I-N. At sfmta.com. And I'll say some of the comments today reflect our daily reality where some people have very strong opinions. Sometimes they're directly contradictory. So we have both today we've heard not enough fare enforcement and too much fare enforcement. Some people say Clipper's the best thing that's happened to transit in San Francisco, and some people say it's the worst.
Just like when I do a program. People say it's the best program and the worst program, depending on what it is. But thank you all for being with us and making this program so enlightening. Ed Riskin, again, is Director of Transportation for the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency. Rick Lobsher, Board Chair and President of Market Street Railway. And Gerald Cawthon, recently part of SaveMuni.com and also formerly Chief Project Manager of the PUC's engineering projects, including Muni. Thank you for being with us on this first hour of Forum. Another hour ahead is going to be all about entertainment. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll and executive producer Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.